Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our first of three book signing lectures on new books. Thank you for coming out on this wet day, even though we'll have a more beautiful summer because of it. You may have noticed if you came down the stairs, the stones, and those are stones from the old reservoir. When they knocked this building down, 100 years ago, they didn't keep the foundation, but they did keep the stonework, some of it, so that's what that is. My name is Jay Barksdale. I have the pleasure of being a librarian in this fine building and institution, and I also handle the details of the Allen Room and the Wertheim Study, which are rooms put aside for writers to use away from hoi polloi and convenience and ease. And they're the last places on earth that's truly quiet. They're great. There's an email sign-up sheet if you wish to add your name to the list for future lectures. Please be legible. The Pun Also Rises is available for sale and signing afterwards. I don't think I've left anything out. Our speaker today, I've heard him introduce himself at cocktail parties by saying, "You know that Western civilization owes it all to the pun," and that gets it going. He was a special assistant to the president and a presidential speechwriter for Bill Clinton. Prior to that, he worked in Capitol Hill as a speechwriter for the House Democratic Whip, David Bonoir, and wrote on a large range of issues. He began his career as a journalist, worked in the United States and Spain, where he wrote for U.S. newspapers and the Associated Press. He won the 1995 O. Henry World Pun Championship, which I understand he's going to speak a little bit about today. He has written two other books, The World on a String, How to Become a Freelance for a Correspondent, and one I can personally recommend as a really great read, Cork Boat, which chronicles the true story of his 30-year struggle quest to build a Viking ship entirely from wine corks. And its 2002 voyage down Portugal's Douro River. In addition to writing books, he works as a communications consultant with ROI Communications. He's a native at Ann Arbor. He earned his BA in American Studies from Stanford, and he lives in New York City. Without further ado, please welcome John Pollock.
Okay, well, again, thank you all for coming out today. Can everyone hear me in the back? Okay, is this mic okay? Great. There are several people who made this book possible. Here I am adjusting the light and not the mic. There we go. There are several people who made this book possible. At Gotham Books, my editor, Rachel Holtzman, and Lisa Johnson, the associate publisher, and Bill Schenker. Are you here? I think you were up there, back there. And so thank you for coming today. Jillian McKenzie, my great agent, was unable to join us today. She's not feeling well. And then, of course, Jay Barksdale, who you just met. And Jay was really helpful throughout this the research of this book. And in several ways, and I like to think of E.B. White, and here is New York, where he says, no one should come to New York to live unless he's willing to be lucky. And one day, I after I had embarked upon the research for The Pun Also Rises, I was in the big reading room feeling a little bit overwhelmed. I mean, you see all these people, you know, studying away, and there's endless books, and you know that the stacks go deep beneath. And the more you read, the less you know, or the more you realize what you haven't read, and it can be rather intimidating. And I went up to the reference desk to ask a question, and lo and behold, Jay was on duty there, and I told him about the project, and very dryly he recommended an excellent book by Jim Holt called Stop Me If You've Heard This, A History and Philosophy of Jokes. And so I got that book, and I read it, and it was a very influential book just in terms of tone and just the depth of scholarship and the mysteries of joke-telling that go back thousands and thousands of years. And at the end of this brief conversation about this book, I said, you know, listen, I heard that Robert Caro wrote The Power Broker here, secreted away in some office. And is there office space? And he said, not only is there office space, but I'm in charge of it. And so I felt that there I was, willing to get lucky. And I spent the next 9 months, basically, ensconced in the Wertheim room, working away and drawing on the resources of this great library. So today I want to tell you a little bit about how I came to write this book and then talk to you about the pun, its rise and fall, and its rise again, and how the pun enabled the was a key catalyst in the rise of civilization. So as the family story goes, my first sentence in life was a pun. My mom was a little bit worried because I was 2 and a half or so, and I was saying words, but I wasn't stringing sentences together. She thought, well, maybe he's just not as bright as his older sister. And I walked into the kitchen one day, and she said, Johnny, go put on your shoes. I don't want you walking barefoot. And I looked up, I looked down, I looked up at her and giggled and said, bears go barefoot. And I was off and running. So flash forward almost 30 years, and I hear that there's this world pun championship. And this is 95, it's pre-web. You actually had to get on the telephone to find things. And being the determined reporter, 3 or 4 or 5 phone calls later, I found it. And I got the organizer on the phone. I asked, you know, when is it? He said, it's a week from Sunday. And I said, a week from Sunday? Well, how do I enter? And he said, well, it's actually filled up. We limited it to 32 candidates. And I said, is there any way that I can come down and compete? And he said, well, actually, we did have a cancellation. There's one spot. And he quizzed me on the phone, and I took my frequent flyer miles, and I flew on down to Texas. And the contest is set up like a tournament. There's a judge and a timekeeper, and you're paired with an opponent, and they pick a topic, and you have 5 seconds to make a pun on that topic. And then your opponent has 5 seconds. And you go back and forth at 5-second intervals until someone chokes. Single elimination, no mercy, you're out of there. So the first round, I'm really nervous. I mean, I've never done this before. I had punned over the dinner table with my dad all these years. I had gotten a feel for 5 seconds, you know, 5-second intervals in the preceding week, but I was up against a former champion, and I just thought, oh. And he was just so casual up there, because, of course, he was a former champion. Who was this walk-on from Michigan? So they pick the topic, and it's air vehicles. And I say, well, I hope I pick the right flying machine. And the judge says, son, you got to make a pun. And I said, W-R-I-G-H-T, I hope I pick the right flying machine. And the crowd cheers, and it's like Rocky Balboa landing a punch on Apollo Creed. And drawing blood, and suddenly they know a brawl's on. And he says, well, I'm going to be 52 next week, so I'm never going to see 47 again. And I say, well, I'm going to be 29 next week, so I'm never going to be 17 again. He said, I was hoping you'd be one bomber. So it goes back and forth, back and forth. This guy's unbelievable. And I'm, you know, struggling, but I'm coming up with stuff. And at one point he says, oh, you're just up here winging it. And I look at him and said, you too? So I thought for sure that was going to take him out, but no, he kept going. It went the full 7 minutes, and then it goes to audience vote on quality. And so by some great good fortune, the audience took pity and advanced me to the next round. And I ended up going through 4 or 5 more rounds to beat a paramedic on external body parts. So you might ask, how do they judge, you know, whether something's a pun or not in this contest? Now they actually have a panel of judges, as opposed to then when it was just a judge. Anybody who's interested, May 21st in Austin, Texas, come on down. It'll be exciting. I'm actually judging this year. And the definition of a pun is a very slippery thing, and people have struggled to define it for hundreds and hundreds of years. And Puns are a subset of wordplay, and they can take a lot of different forms. Probably the simplest, most common type is the humorous use of a word in such a way that it can be interpreted different ways based on its sound. So bears go barefoot, perfect example, two different kinds of bear, they sound the same. And the brain has to go through some quite extraordinary mental gymnastics to pull the meaning from essentially compressed air. We get these sound waves coming at us. They vibrate our eardrum, and the brain has to suck meaning out of these words that can sound exactly alike. How does that happen? It's actually a very complex process, and the fMRI studies that have been done can't even quite figure it out. But I'm not going to talk much about that today. You can read it in the book if you're interested. But the point is that puns today are often considered juvenile or low wit. And they're really very, very complex. Even a knock-knock joke. So knock-knock. Max. Max, no difference. Okay. So that's the brain has to approximate Max to makes and pull meaning out of it. Now, when a child learns knock-knock jokes early in elementary school or before even, that's the first time in their life where they are learning to read meaning beyond the surface of a word, beneath the surface of a word. And where would we be in life if we couldn't intuit meaning from incomplete information, and when somebody says something, we think, well, they really mean not X, but Y. Or maybe they mean X and Y, which is it? And so that's a very complex linguistic and neurological process that happens. And so don't let anybody tell you that puns are simple or unimportant. They actually date back about 35,000 years. And that's before the wheel, I might add. The first evidence we have of it are carved stone statuettes about the size of an Oscar. And if you look at one face of it, it's a naked woman. If you rotate it 180 degrees, it's a phallus. And what it shows is that people could conceive of opposites united in a single object, two ideas that were different but joined, and what you see depends on how you look at it. And that really was history's first double entendre. And so, of course, today they take many, many more forms, but they also cross many, many cultures. From the Aborigines in the Australian outback who speak Pitjantjatjara, I had to practice that one, Pitjantjatjara, and French philosophers and the speakers of Tzotzil, which is a Mayan language in the Chiapas Highlands of southern Mexico, very elaborate punning rituals. Chinese bloggers today are punning with abandon. And so there's this broad tradition and deep tradition of punning that crosses every major language group. And I set out to find out why. What is it about punning that makes it so intrinsic to human language? What are the biological reasons punning would give us an evolutionary advantage in the survival of the fittest? And so the book goes into some of this too. But given that the pun enjoys the pun suffers somewhat of a low status today, I want to talk about the rise and fall of the pun in Western civilization and how it got that way. Who here is a punster? See a show of hands. Okay, so about a third of you. And what are some common reactions to the pun? Groans. Okay, we're going to talk about the groan because the groan is actually, we're going to get to that a little bit later. The groan is actually not a ubiquitous response to the pun. It is a common response in certain circumstances, but I want you to just consider this for a little. for thousands of years, the pun was a respected rhetorical tool, and it wasn't even necessarily considered humorous. It was a rhetorical tool, a device that Plato praised and Aristotle praised and Cicero praised, and throughout the history of Western civilization until the last 300-400 years, was just like any other rhetorical device, and it conveyed multiplicity of meaning. And the English, especially, has been very rich in pun potential, in part because it's such a mix of other languages. At the time of Shakespeare, punning was high art, and Shakespeare and his contemporaries punned a great deal, both in serious ways and humorous ways. Shakespeare was the first documented knock-knock joke. It's in the book, and it doesn't translate. I can't remember it offhand, but it doesn't translate as humorous today, unless you catch the puns in the answer, which were dependent on knowing Elizabethan English. And it's said that half of Shakespeare's puns have been lost to history because pronunciation has migrated away from the way people spoke then. But at that time, you had the influence of hundreds of years of French occupation of England following the Norman invasion. You had the import of Sanskrit words, guru, pariah, tadi, kat. All these were coming into English with the merchantmen who were coming back from India. You had Norse words like not, haggle, and law. And so English was an amalgam of languages, and following the Black Death in the 1300s, you had a huge social upheaval, so you had a mixing of regional accents. And then London became a center where and you had this great oral culture where people would go to these plays, and puns were a great way to pack more meaning into very economically into fewer lines and to hold people's attention, because they're not used to watching, they're not used to such visual stimulus. It's oral, and most of the people there in the early years were illiterate, and they went to the theater and they listened. So what were the factors that sent the pun from high art into decline? And there were several: social, ideological, and technological. Let's take technology. The rise of the printing press. So the first printing press came to England, I think, in 1476. Maybe it was 1475, somewhere thereabouts. And it took a while, but it became an incredibly powerful tool. Now, what does printing force you to do? It forces you to favor one spelling over another. Puns, at their best, are an oral form, and their power comes from ambiguity. And the ambiguity is lost when you choose a spelling and therefore favor one meaning over the other. And so as printing took root and the culture in England shifted from an oral culture to more of a print culture, it forced a standardization of English, and it also sapped language of some of its ambiguity. A second factor was the influence of the coffee houses in London. So in the Puritan years, following the Revolution, the English Revolution, there was a surge in coffee houses in London. It was a new drink. This was pre-tea in England, if you can believe it. And coffee was incredibly powerful as a stimulant, it was so powerful, in fact, that the tavern keepers hated the coffee house people because they were taking away some of their business. And the people would mix in these coffee houses at long tables. And there's a great collection of papers in the collection here of coffee-related documents through that time period. And one might think, oh, that's a really obscure collection to order. I looked, it was so good, I looked at the price online, and it was, I don't know, $700 for the collection. And of course, that's a year's worth of coffee. I'm not going to do that. So I was grateful that the library time and again had what I needed. But what happened was this democratization where social classes started to mix at the coffee houses. And as a consequence, what some of the upper intellectual classes found were that, boy, the common man is pretty smart. And that was off-putting. That was challenging. And what had been considered high wit, namely punning, was now viewed with a little bit of suspicion. If everyone could do it, what was the use of it? It didn't really distinguish a person's intelligence or their eloquence. And so that was a factor. And some of the people who were hanging out in the coffee houses were all the emerging scientists, because this was the beginning of the Enlightenment, and where there was an attempt to classify, to apply scientific rigor, to try and impose some semblance of order on the world. Newton, for example, and members of the Royal Society hung out at a place called the Grecian. And the Grecian, if you go to London today, is still operating. I went to track it down because it plays a role in the book. And it's a pub today called the Devereux, but it's essentially they just traded caffeine for liquor and beer. And the Enlightenment, the leaders of the Enlightenment in England really hated puns because puns were ambiguous. They were very slippery. Language did not seem to be yielding as easily as the natural world did through mathematics, calculus, biology, and all the rigorous structure that revealed itself as the scientists applied it. So puns became marginalized. They were kind of kicked to the curb of humor. Printing press, democratization, Enlightenment. And so by the time you got to the 1700s, when Samuel Johnson wrote his famous dictionary and really put English on the map as a modern, powerful, rich language, and it didn't hurt that England was conquering the world at that time, he hated the pun. So here was a guy who was the definitive voice of the English language in some circles, railing against the pun to such an extent that he started ripping on Shakespeare, and people started writing collections of Shakespeare trying to eliminate the puns. And a lot of the puns were there to avoid the censors of the time, because the master of revels in Elizabethan England would forbid certain topics, and puns in all cultures are often used to overcome and address taboo subjects. So, for example, the Tsotsil speakers of the Chiapas Highlands have these elaborate pun duels called kahelkop, and they'll pun back and forth, and a lot of times it'll be getting at taboo subjects such as, I want to date your sister. And it's a way of overcoming these taboos. So Johnson ripped on it, and so the pun fell in status further. Now, I think this is a key point to make here. Those that rail against puns usually do so except when they make them. They might not make them as often as others, but there are a few people who don't make them occasionally, at least. And there's a great little book in the rare book collection here called The Punster's Pocketbook, and it was published in 1826, and it tells the story. I was so happy to find this little nugget in there. Johnson was walking through London with Boswell, his biographer, and they're passing Old Bailey, the courts, and they see a crowd gathering, and he says, Bozzy, go find out what's going on. And he comes back and says, well, listen, they're about to hang a man. They're gathering for an execution. And Johnson says, well, find out who it is. And he goes out, and it turns out that the condemned man's name is Mr. Vowell. And Johnson says, well, Bozzy, it's very clear that it's neither you nor I. Clearly, he had no problem with capital punishment. So there you had the decline in England. Now, of course, in the United States, what England didn't like, we liked, of course, because we're a new country and our sense of humor is somewhat different. And there's a long tradition of punning that predates colonization. Many Native American tribes were big punsters and are big punsters. And in fact, William Penn, when he came to Pennsylvania originally, what would become Pennsylvania, he was given the Algonquin nickname Onas, meaning feather, because feather was the pen of its day, and that's what they used to sign things. And so the governors of Pennsylvania for many years afterward were known as Onas. A lot of preachers in colonial New England were punsters, and these were respected Presbyterians. I mean, they weren't people putting out on the signboards, as you see today, God answers an email and the sun cures sinburn and things like that. If you Google punning sign church signboards, incredibly clever hooks outside churches today. Ben Franklin was a big punster. His first pseudonym was Silence Do-Good. Of course, he wasn't too silent. And Thomas Jefferson had some commentary that I uncovered on punning where he writes a letter to Abigail Adams in 1787 from the Constitutional Convention, and I'll paraphrase, but he basically says, listen, if everyone would just stop making puns for a few minutes, we might get a country here. And then he adds, and if there were ever an armed rebellion, a good punster could put it down. So how did we get to this point today where, as some of you suggest, that the groan is such a common response? Well, in the 20th century, you had this big surge of immigrants and leading the charge in terms of influence on humor were the Jews. You had Jack Benny, you had the Marx Brothers, you had Henny Youngman, Gracie Allen, George Burns. I mean, the list goes on and on. And puns were a big part of early 20th century comedy and vaudeville. But after the war, comedy shifted, and it became the comedy of dysfunction, of drugs, of sex, of taboo subjects in a time when there were fewer and fewer taboos. Lenny Bruce, Woody Allen, much more free-form puns, which do well in societies where there are a lot of taboos, suddenly started to be marooned. They were set pieces. They were old-fashioned. And the rim shot, ba-dum-bum, that was originally a vaudeville sign of affirmation, and it took on a sarcastic tone about that time. And so the pun was suddenly marooned, and you start to hear more and more groans. Now, groans are not unique to the late 20th century. People groaned in Cicero's time, too, but it wasn't considered the universal response. And even though many people perceive groans to be a universal response to punning today, groans can mean many things. They can mean, I got that, and it was terrible. It could mean, I didn't get it, but I don't want to admit it. It could mean, that was actually pretty good, but I don't want to encourage you. It can mean a lot of different things. But in a lot of situations, puns don't evoke groans at all. So let me give you a few examples. Who saw the movie Ratatouille? Yeah. I mean, it's full of puns. They're very, very clever. For those of you who don't know, it's a Disney movie about a rat who decides to be a chef, a French chef, and his struggles to do so. Austin Powers. Anybody here seen the Austin Powers movies? Yeah. Okay. Ivana Humpalot. And Austin Powers. You know, she's the villain. And he says, well, you know, and I want a toilet out of solid gold, but it's not in the cards now, is it? Romeo and Juliet. We see those posters everywhere. So puns in those instances don't evoke groans necessarily. What about headlines? Wall Street Journal, more and more now, is joining the ranks of some of the tabs. And we see great, clever headlines that don't evoke groans for the most part. there we think, ah, that's clever. And again, the power of the pun is to pack layered meaning into short real estate. And in a newspaper, nothing is more precious than real estate. Oh, here we go. What do we have today? The Grin Reaper. Yeah, and if you open it up, there'll be a lot more. Now, I wanted to see when punning headlines first came into play, and so I went down just around the corner here and got on the microfiche machines and started scrolling through hundreds of years of New York newspapers. It's very interesting. It's a great excursion. I highly recommend it, even if you have nothing specific in mind that you're looking for, because you see names that later become famous in their infancy, and we only recognize them now in retrospect. But puns in headlines actually emerged about 1940 in the New York Daily News. It's interesting that the Post is generally beats them every day on puns now, but it was the Daily News, and it was about a New Year's party at the Rainbow Room, which was new at that time, relatively new. And as the story goes, this, as they describe it, blonde bombshell was doing the conga about midnight, and the Eddie LeBaron orchestra is playing away, and she starts lifting her dress above her knees, and then and a guy shouts out, you know, take it all the way, baby. And she like whips off the dress, and then the dress is stuck, and the orchestra screeches to a halt. The whole dance floor turns to stare, and then somebody shouts, "Keep playing!" And the second violinist, I love the detail in these stories, shouts, "Holy mackerel!" And the dress comes down, and they start playing, and onward into the night. And the headline I think was, "Amateur striptease titillates Rainbow Room. Happy Nude Year." And that was the beginning of punning headlines in New York, and it's never quite been the same. Today's newspaper, The Times, Thomas Friedman puns on the killing of Osama bin Laden, where he says, you know, we've killed him by the bullet. Now it's the people of the Middle East's opportunity to kill his ideology by the ballot. Bullet, ballot. And that kind of punning is not grown worthy. It's just a clever turn of phrase. When we go shopping and we need office supplies, we go to Staples. If you look at the sign, the L is a bent staple, which is a visual pun. Walk into the corner store looking for ice cream, Ben and Jerry's, you've got Caramel Sutra ice cream, or Cherry Garcia, all sorts of good flavors. And then let's take a completely different type of product. Let's take something quite sophisticated. What's the hippest company right now? Apple. So I just got an iPhone 4, and I skipped 1 through 3, but I finally gave in. I got an iPhone 4, and you open up the instruction manual, and it's called fingertips. And you know when Apple's doing something, it's cool. So what we're experiencing now is, I believe, a pun renaissance. And the reason being is that people are so bombarded with information now from all directions. I mean, you can't even walk out down the sidewalk now without people projecting ads onto the sidewalk sometimes, that advertisers and marketers and businesses are looking for any way to catch your attention and get you to double back. Just think for a second and pause with them. And puns are a really effective way to do that. That's what they're designed to do. And in fact, there was a Dutch study that I include in the book that shows consumers actually prefer punning slogans to slogans without puns, even when they only perceive there to be a pun there and there really isn't one. So there's something deeply appealing about puns that the marketplace affirms every single day. So I want to give you one of the big ideas now that I stumbled across in this book. Because when I set out to write this book, and Rachel can attest to this, she looked at the proposal, and I posed some questions about puns. Why, you know, why do we pun? Why do they matter? Why does everyone do them? But I didn't have answers. And what I discovered largely in this library was something really extraordinary, and that is that puns were a key catalyst in the rise of civilization. So let me explain this, because I know that some people think, huh? Mm-hmm. 35,000 years ago, you have a great buffalo hunt, and you want to record it for posterity. You're going to go to the back of your cave, find a flat spot on the wall, light your torch, get out your paints, and paint a dozen buffalo and put arrows in three or four or five of them. And then people will know, wow, they had a good buffalo hunt. Flash forward 30,000 years, and you're in the Fertile Crescent in ancient Mesopotamia, or at the same time actually in Egypt. And people are dealing with an agricultural society. They're writing contracts of law. They're defining land deals. They are writing epic poetry. They're codifying law and religion. And you can't do that. You can't handle those. You can't handle ideas of that complexity with literalism. You can't paint a picture on a cave wall that says, I have a contract to be sold 38 cattle next autumn to be sold at this market at this price, and if there are less cattle, then a reduction of this price. You can't do that, and yet that's what people were wrestling with. And the intellectual breakthrough to get, you need relational words, you need abstractions, and the intellectual breakthrough that the scribes of the time had was that you could break apart sound and symbol and meaning and recombine them. And by stripping images of most of their meaning, you could just use their phonetic value and use those phonetic building blocks as sort of a proto-alphabet to write more complex words and communicate more complex ideas. And I went to the way that they did this was through punning. Both the Babylonians and Sumerians and the Egyptians were big punsters, as it turns out. There's a great book called Everyday Life in Ancient Babylon and Assyria. It's not going to be on the bestseller list anytime soon, but for those of you who are curious, I highly recommend it. Anyways, it talks about some of the puns in ancient Mesopotamia. And in fact, the story of Noah is based on a Babylonian flood myth 500 years earlier or so, where there's a pantheon of gods, and the most powerful one says, I'm done with this lot down there. I'm going to flood the earth. And a lesser god goes to his one of his top worshipers and says, hey, I'm paraphrasing, hey, there's a flood coming. You got to build a boat, and you got to get two of everything onto the boat and save life. And the worshiper says, well, all right, but you know, once I start building a boat, what are the neighbors going to say? And the god says, tell them that it's going to rain Kibtu and Kuku. And Kibtu and Kuku in ancient Babylonian meant corn and the sound of corn being ground. In an agricultural society, hey, bumper crop coming, we're in luck. But they're actually puns for grief and misfortune. Those who missed history's first corny puns paid with their lives. So I went off to England to talk to the top Egyptologist at the British Museum, because I really wanted to see if was this true for Egypt too. And he said, oh, of course. And then the Rosetta Stone is down there with at least one pun in it. And he said, and the pyramid texts are full of puns. And he said, check out the catalog from the 1977 exhibit on blah, blah, blah. Lo and behold, I go on the catalog here when I'm back, and it's here. And it's just a testament to this library that they would have some obscure catalog from the British Museum, 15 or 20 years old, in the collections. And the ancient Egyptians and the Babylonians didn't quite make it to the alphabet. They came to the brink of it, but their languages were still a hybrid of symbols with meaning and symbols with sound. About 1700 BC, however, a group of punning scribes in the Sinai took it all away. And they stripped symbols entirely of their literal meaning, their symbolic meaning, and gave them purely phonetic values. And it was a 30-character alphabet. The Greeks later added vowels, which was very good of them. And the word alphabet, in fact, is a portmanteau pun combining alpha and beta, the first two letters of that alphabet. So what happens when you have an alphabet? Okay, now you can accumulate knowledge. You can transmit, you can write about anything. It's accessible to a much broader group of people, both scholarly and layperson. And you can transmit detailed information, not just over distance, which is important, but over time. And so when you can transmit detailed information over time, now you can accumulate knowledge. And as Jared Diamond talks about in Guns, Germs, and Steel, the invention of writing was just a key breakthrough that enabled, you know, the acceleration of human progress. I mean, we basically stumbled along for 150,000 years of anatomical modernity, and then suddenly, with the invention of writing, boom, we saw the rise of civilization. And it was punning that enabled the invention of the alphabet. No puns, no alphabet, no writing, no library here, no great metropolis we call New York City. And essentially, no pun, no modern civilization. So I'm going to wrap it up now and take questions, but I basically want you to think about, we're here at the New York Public Library, one of the world's great libraries. It's a monument to the written word. And the written word is fueled at its core by the pun. And all of, we think about, I go upstairs, like before I gave this talk, I went up to the Great Reading Room because I draw inspiration from all these people who are bettering themselves by reading, by tapping away on their laptops, by studying, by trying to learn. And what they're doing is taking ideas and associating them in new ways. Some of these ideas are familiar to them, some are not. But this is the great leap that punning makes from idea to idea to idea. That's an act of intellectual construction. And so was when thousands of years ago when somebody realized that when you bang two rocks together, you get a spark. Oh, well, with a spark, you can light, put some dry grass there and light a fire. With a fire, you can boil water. With boiling water, you can generate electricity. And it's a great series of very unlikely associational leaps, a lot of trial and error that led from the cave to the space station and everything in between, from the signal drum to the iPhone. And so those who would denigrate punning would denigrate the very creative process that has driven all of human progress. Are there bad puns? Plenty of them. I make them. And we all do. Are there brilliant ones? Absolutely. But that's true of science. That's true of cooking. That's true of any creative endeavor. So I would just say, pun with pride and spread the word, because the pun also rises. Yes, sir. The cuneiform is full of puns, and it doesn't surprise me that the Met has some examples of that, and so I'll have to search that one out because I missed that one. Thank you.
Your final note, which is clearly a core idea of your book, suddenly lost me. No puns, no writing.
Sure. Let me try and clarify. Letters of the alphabet mean nothing by themselves. They are sounds. Originally, they developed from symbols that had meaning and evolved over time to lose their symbolic meaning, except for that of the phonetic value. That was a gradual process. And the way that the scribes, as they struggled to describe more and more complex ideas, got to the alphabet was by saying, for example, that the Sumerian symbol for arrow, T-I, sounded like the Sumerian symbol for life. Sumerian symbol for word. They were sounded exactly alike. So that symbol became used for both words because it was a pun. So it was shorthand for it, and then it just became that symbol became just the phonetic value and lost all association with a specific concept or word or meaning. And so if you think of a text message, see you tomorrow at 5. See you tomorrow at sign 5. The C and the U and the at are not spelled out. Those have phonetic value, and we apply meaning to the phonetic value. That's kind of working backward, where we're using shorthand to communicate meanings. Does this clarify things at all? Okay, all right. Yes, sir. I think that that's often true, absolutely. And I always say that sometimes puns are not always appropriate. I mean, they're great appetizers. They're probably not the most nutritious main course. Sort of like eating a bag of potato chips, the first several taste good, and then you go through the whole bag, and then you're like, ugh. And so, but yes, there's a certain claim. It's interesting, because Cicero did the first known pun book. There are joke books that predated him by several hundred years, but he wrote the world's first pun book, and he apparently was notorious for stealing other people's good puns and denying all the bad ones. Yes. Yeah. Okay. So the question is, why do people feel a need to apologize and say, no pun intended? The British version of that is pardon the pun. And that emerged about the time that puns were elbowed into the margins of acceptability during the Enlightenment. And a great and powerful tool, if you haven't seen it, is the Ngram viewer on Google, which takes 5 million books, and you can type in words and phrases and look at the frequency of their appearance over time, and words ebb and flow in their popularity. And if you, I think there's a 5-word limit. And luckily, no pun intended, and pardon the pun, fit within that, and I could track exactly when those came into play. And so in answer to your question, it's a reaction to the social marginalization of puns following the rise of science and this idea that ambiguity was bad. Yes.
But it also calls attention to the pun.
Yes, and sometimes people say it as a way to do that. And it's hard not to, when you think you're clever, to have other people, you know, you don't want people to miss your joke. But as a general rule, it's good to just let it go. If someone misses it, just let it go, and that's okay. Because sometimes puns can be disruptive, and sometimes they can add a lot. And like any other conversational tool, it's good to use them judiciously.
Seems to me that it's a creative act. Some people are good at it, others aren't. And your story about your childhood makes brain was already programmed to be able to make those leaps, those tangential leaps that puns are so good?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, and I don't know the entire answer to that. What I did read is that there are differences between men and women in brain structure, particularly in Broca's area, which is a center that plays a role in verbalization, among other areas, and that sometimes women will process puns of a sexual nature more slowly, not because they don't get the pun, but because there's a social approbation that says, wait, am I breaking the rules by getting this dirty pun? And so there's a self-censorship that slows it down sometimes by a couple, hundredths of a second. But in terms of pre-programming, we're all good at different things. And obviously some people are great at math and it comes easily to them. In my household, I was good at words. My dad was good at math, but he was also good at puns. So there's a lot that scientists don't know about how the brain works, but with some of the new imaging technology, hopefully over time we'll figure that out. Yes.
Association, almost unlikely but brilliant association, and he sort of worked it out neuroscientifically, the connection between this phenomenon of synesthesia and making metaphor. Well, I think we're onto something very different with this gentleman's question.
Yes.
Very, very similar.
Yes, and it's that, and I in non-technical terms, I describe myself as a lateral thinker and making connections that do that. So let's take one last question, if there are any, and then let people go. Yes?
Do you see any connection between metaphor and punning?
Absolutely. I do see a connection between metaphor and punning, because both you're trying to associate two disparate ideas and create some order out of them. Some people who really like order don't like puns because puns show the instability of language, and they show that the way we classify the world is in many ways arbitrary, and that can be threatening. I also think that it again is a fuel for creativity, and that we need to celebrate the pun, not just because puns can be really fun, but because the way we create in this world is the way we're going to solve problems. And, goodness knows we've got a lot of problems to solve in this world. So thank you again for coming. I appreciate it.